Good morning. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. Real Life is the radio show that's dedicated to women who are ready to love life and make joy a part of the daily dialogue. So here we are, ladies, another Saturday morning, and this next 60 minutes can be just about you. I invite you to join me in getting your favorite beverage. This morning, I'm actually just having some water. So I invite you to get whatever feels good to you this morning and find a quiet place to let the next 60 minutes be just about you. When we think of Buddhism, some of us often think of silent monks in a remote Eastern location practicing and meditating, set aside from the world in which the rest of us live. But as Buddhism teaches us, this too is an illusion in today's world of socially engaged Buddhism. For those of you who still see Buddhism as primarily passive, my guest today, Sally King, is ready to open your eyes to a world in which the Buddhists are actively and intimately involved in issues that concern all of us. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining me this morning.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, and you know, I want to let folks know what you are up to in the world and your life. And Sally is a professor of philosophy and religion at James Madison University in Harrisonburg, and she is the author of many books and articles on Buddhism and engaged Buddhism and some Quakerism, among many other things that I'm eager to hear about over this next 60 minutes, Sally.
So, great.
Yeah, so one of the questions I want to start with is, how big is the gulf between what people think of Buddhism and socially engaged Buddhism?
I think you put it correctly in the introduction that a lot of people think of Buddhism in terms of a religion that's very cut off from sort of practical everyday life. But I think people have a disconnect in their mind because at the same time, most people are familiar with the Dalai Lama, who is a part of engaged Buddhism, and I think most people recognize that he stands for compassion and kindness and a very universalistic worldview, and at the same time, they're aware, pretty aware, I think, that he is a kind of a figurehead and a leader in a movement to change the status of Tibet with respect to China, so that's a political issue. A lot of people are familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh, who's the second most famous Buddhist teacher in the West. I don't know how many people know that he was a leader of the Buddhist movement during the war in Vietnam to try to bring that war to an end. And then beyond those two, I think what hardly anybody in this country knows is that they are just two of many, many Buddhists in all the Buddhist countries of the world, with the exception of a few where there's insufficient freedom, but most of the Buddhist countries then, where Buddhism is very much involved with all kinds of social and political issues.
What kinds of issues does the gap in that thinking create when you're teaching or writing or just interacting with people?
Well, I don't know that it creates any particular issues per se. And in fact, I think the fact that there is that gap is also partly being met from a different side, because Buddhism, as it is evolving in the West and in this country in particular, is already changing. You know, Buddhism started in India. It spread throughout Asia centuries ago, and now it is spreading to the West. And every time it comes to a new culture, it changes. So in addition to the engaged Buddhism movement that's very important and prominent in Asia, in this country, you already find Buddhism engaging in a somewhat new way with ordinary everyday life issues, issues of going to work, issues of relationships and people's personal emotional life, psychological issues. And this is new for Buddhism as well. So I think Buddhism is evolving very rapidly right now. It has some really outstanding leadership, both in the West and in Asia. So it's a very dynamic tradition. And when people start finding out about this, I think they're kind of pleased because in many ways, it makes Buddhism, I think, fulfill some of the things that Westerners expect of Buddhism, but maybe they didn't know they were going to find in there.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And if you're just joining us this morning, I am joined by Sally King, who is a professor of philosophy and religion at James Madison University. And she has also written a number of books on Buddhism and engaged Buddhism and Quakerism. And she's sharing her story. Sally, I'm really very interested to hear about your journey through, well, just your journey to finding engaged Buddhism. How did you start?
Well, for me, I got interested in Buddhism when I was an undergraduate student in college, and I was already interested in philosophy and religion and all the great questions in life, and I took a course on Buddhism, and it immediately spoke to me. I think that many people feel that way when they run into Buddhism. It just made a lot of sense, and I just followed it more and more, and I did graduate studies in the area, and ultimately I became a professor, and my specialty is Buddhism, but it took some while to find engaged Buddhism for me. It hadn't become that available, I think, in the West. So when I first found it was in reading Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Being Peace, which is a great classic of engaged Buddhism, and a lot of people know that book.
Yeah.
And I was quite taken by it at that time. So after that, my husband and I and our two children actually went to Plum Village in France, where Thich Nhat Hanh lives, and they have a summer open period when people are invited to come and stay for up to a month. And I was very curious at the time, actually, as a mother, to see what Buddhism had to offer children, because that was also something I couldn't find, and also something that I saw was going on in Thich Nhat Hanh's work. So the four of us went and spent a month in Plum Village, and I was really particularly interested, as I say, to see how the sort of family Buddhist practice and the practice for children was going to go, and that was quite delightful.
What was that? And, what was that like for children?
It just sort of grew on me from there, I guess.
What was the what were the practices as a family or for children? I'm interested to hear that too.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because this is, you know, part of the image that Buddhism has. And it's part of the difficulty, I think, for Western Buddhism, just because we haven't got the institutions really complete yet. But some of the practices there for children, well, for example, walking meditation. A lot of people know that Thich Nhat Hanh has popularized walking meditation, and he's changed it just a little bit. Everything he does changes things a little bit without ever, you know, losing the real heart and soul of the thing. So walking meditation becomes something you can do with your children and that children can enjoy. So it's walking out in nature and actually enjoying nature and really trying to immerse yourself, walking slowly. And if you want to stop and smell a flower, you do that. If you want to, you know, look at the beautiful blue sky, you do that. And so that's just a natural for children. So all kinds of families were there, these long lines of adults and children walking through the countryside, really enjoying it. And so this is also part of the flavor, I would say, of Thich Nhat Hanh's approach to Buddhism. Very enjoyable. And, of course, that makes it fun for kids. Thich Nhat Hanh always says he doesn't call a retreat a, what is it? He doesn't call a retreat a retreat. He calls it a treat.
Oh,
and
I love
so,
it. That's great.
The practice really is a treat. And so another thing, I still laugh when I think about it, he would have a tea ceremony, very different from the Japanese kind, which is very, very formal. The tea ceremony at Plum Village, the kids were there along with everybody, and we would have tea and cookies, and people would share songs, and everybody would sort of join in on the song and tell stories, and so it was very kid-friendly, and I remember my kids kind of, you know, sitting quietly, nodding, and then pass the cookies. So, you know, it was real. It was real kids being like real kids. And at the beginning of his Dharma talks, his talks on the teachings of Buddhism, he'd always take the first 10 minutes or so and really address the children, really speak on a level that children could understand. And then he would say, if you want to stay, you can stay and hear more. But if you want to leave and just go out and play, you can do that. Mm. So, you know, it was very appropriate for children. They developed some songs, were very, very simple, short songs that would sort of capture the spirit of compassion, for example, to sort of, you know, a child could learn a very short song, and that would sort of keep the idea of compassion more toward the front of the mind, that sort of thing. So, you know, it was, as a mother, and I think my husband felt the same way as a father, it was just a wonderful place to be with children. And you don't think of that when you think of a Buddhist retreat, which is, in this case, a treat.
Sally, what practice were you able to bring back from the treat, as opposed to the retreat, that you found useful in your life as a parent?
Well, some of the practices were things like, one of them, Thich Nhat Hanh very frequently uses a bell of mindfulness. So at any moment, you might ring this bell of mindfulness just at random times through the day. This is in Plum Village. Mm-hmm. And then anyone who heard the bell would just stop whatever they were doing for a minute and sort of breathe and smile, as Thich Nhat Hanh says. So just become quiet and breathe quietly and sort of return to yourself and then go back to whatever you're doing. And he also recommended you can do this if there's a conflict in the family. You can just ring the bell. And, you know, if there's some kind of argument going on or something like that, everybody will sort of remember how they want to be and just take a moment and, you know, calm down and become quiet. And then after that sort of pause, then you can return, hopefully, in a sort of refreshed way to whatever the differences are about and work them out a little bit better. Things like that, things like having a sitting practice and inviting the children just to sit for even 1 minute or 2 minutes if they want, just to, you know, not feel that there's something mysterious here that they're excluded from, but that they're welcome to. Mm. That's a couple of examples.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And if you're just joining us this morning, I am joined by Sally King, who is a professor over at JMU in Harrisonburg, and she teaches philosophy and religion, and she's written a number of books on the same. Sally, you had told me that you are involved with some interreligious dialogue and organizations. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's something I've been interested in for a very long time, because one of my concerns, and it's a part of this concern with spiritually based engagement with the problems of the world, of course. As everyone's aware, religion plays a role in conflict. We'd like to think of it more. And when people talk about their own religion, it's always, yeah, my religion is all about peace. But somehow when religions get together, it's not all about peace. Mm. And so interreligious dialogue really, it's quite variable depending upon the religions involved. Sometimes it is about issues of how to get along in the world without blowing the world up, how to sort of make peace and agree to disagree in some ways and work out issues in other ways. Sometimes it's that kind of thing. Other times, interreligious dialogue is more personal. It's more about, we live in a religiously plural world, and now with people moving about as much as they do and electronic communications, we have opportunities to know about a multitude of religions, and I really think it is the case that many people may be born into one religion, but they find things of value in other religions as well. And so I think many people have a kind of an interreligious dialogue going on within themselves, and sometimes, I think most of the time, there's no problem with that, but then sometimes, you know, a question may come up where maybe a person might be drawing on two religions or influenced by two religions, and maybe they might seem to point in different directions about a particular issue or something like that, and then you start to wonder. So interreligious dialogue, I guess it's going on within an individual. It goes on between neighbors, in local communities, on the international level, so many different forms. And I think it's an important component in the world trying to sort itself out as things get more and more crowded and sort of more and more confusing in life.
So you personally practice, you're a practicing Quaker and Buddhist, and I know that you lead workshops combining those. How do you blend the two of those?
Well, the thing is, it's not just me by any means. Quakers have a national gathering once a year called Friends General Conference, and one year I was asked to speak at that conference on the subject of Quakerism and Buddhism. So I was standing in front of an audience, I think about, I don't know, maybe 1,500 people, something like that, all of them Quakers. And at the very start of my talk, I said, I know I'm not the only one who sees a kind of a connection here. And so I just invited anyone in the audience, if they, these Quakers, if they had in some way taken Buddhism into their spiritual lives, would they please stand up? And 85 to 90% of that room stood up. And I was just floored. I could hardly speak. I was so amazed. So there, I think it's fair to say many people do perceive this kind of connection because, well, both of these religions are ways that, well, for example, in Buddhism, there's something called Buddha nature, which is the idea that Buddhahood, which is wisdom and compassion, is within all of us, and our task in life is basically to get in touch with that and develop it and live it more and more. And in Quakerism, there's something called the light within, which is pretty similar, actually. It's technically speaking, it's the third person of the Trinity, the Holy Spirit, which Quakers feel is within each one of us. And so there's this sort of inner light, we often call it, which is similarly expressed in wisdom and, I guess the word there would be, love. And so both of these traditions really expect people to look within and get in touch with this sort of inner wisdom, this inner guide, and develop it. And because of that, they are, although both sides have scriptures, they take the scriptures as more or less guides, not as sort of absolute external authorities. So there's a lot in common, in fact.
You know, I lead Dances of Universal Peace, and what I find, and what that is sacred phrases and mantras taken from the different spiritual traditions from around the world and set to beautiful melody and simple movement. And I find, in my experience over the last 20 years, is that so many of the messages from all of the traditions are common.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I'm very sympathetic to that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the messages are very similar when you get down to it. And as far as I'm concerned, the various religions are more or less methods of approaching the divine, if you use that language, methods of getting in touch with truth. And so as far as I'm concerned, the best thing to do, and this is much like what the Dalai Lama says, he says this all the time, you have to find the method or the path that really works for you. But there is a sense that when you do find a path that works for you, then it kind of runs parallel in a lot of ways to other paths. They're all about, in a sense, finding something greater than ourselves as individuals and trying experientially to get our this sense of the ego self out of the center of the picture and have something else more in the forefront of our minds.
So for many of my listeners this morning, Sally, ego self might be a new term that we're not familiar with, and I'm hoping you can illuminate us.
Okay. It's a kind of a big subject, so I'm just kind of wondering how to talk about it. Yeah. If I speak about it from a Buddhist point of view, the idea is that, let me put it this way. In American culture, compared to some other cultures, we are an extremely individualistic culture.
Mm-hmm.
Some other cultures are more sort of communitarian. The individual gets more of his or her identity from the group. We are extremely individualistic. That has its pros and cons. But the downside of it is that the individual, or the ego self, put it that way, can feel pretty alone and sometimes threatened by all sorts of things outside. And certainly from a Buddhist point of view, it's a bit of a mistake. It's more than a bit of a mistake. It's a big mistake to understand ourselves as so alone and so much an individual, so totally separate from other people, totally separate from the environment, from the world, from society. We're in fact very much interdependent, interconnected with other people and with the world that we live in. But this whole sense of aloneness, fear, anxiety, that's a manifestation of an ego self that's pretty unhappy, in fact. So a lot of Buddhism, and I think a lot of religions, are about putting us more in contact with things other than ourselves, with other people, with the divine, if it's a religion that speaks in terms of the divine, with the world, with society.
You know, I just saw a beautiful movie this past week that's reminding me of what you're talking about, and it's called The Lost Boys of Sudan. And if anybody listening hasn't heard it, I strongly recommend it. I got it through Netflix. And basically, I won't go into the whole story, but the reason for the reminder is that there were some number of young men who came from Sudan to the United States, and they were used to being in community all day, all day, all day, all day. And in fact, you know, they slept in rooms where there were many people. And so when they came to this country, they started to feel very isolated, and some of them didn't thrive as a result. There were starting to be some mental health issues because he said, I don't see my roommate for 3 weeks because of their work schedules and how everything was working. So, and you know, I personally am on a kick reminding women to reach out, to remember that we are part of community and that we don't have to go through difficult times alone or go through joyful times alone. We are, and I think in our culture and for us women, it is really easy to isolate when things start feeling hard. I really appreciate your pointing out the sense of community. And Sally, we need to take a short break here, and I encourage you, the listener, to stay tuned, because when we come back, Sally King will be my guest for the second half of the show. We'll be right back.